This is a good time to consider the career of German director Fritz Lang. His 1931 film, M, which launched Peter Lorre's film career, has been re-released. And so has Jean-Luc Godard's film, Contempt, in which Lang plays a film director. One of Lang's first films was the silent classic Metropolis. One of his last was the 1950s gangster classic The Big Heat. He is inarguably one of the cinema's visionaries. It's his life that's controversial. Lang made his early movies in Germany. He fled the Hitler regime in 1933, although Hitler and propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels were great fans of his work, and Lang may have had closer ties to them than he let on. Lang's wife, who was also his screenwriter, Thea von Harbo, was a Nazi sympathizer and remained in Germany. Lang made many crime films. He was obsessed with the idea of the innocent man falsely accused, perhaps because his first wife died of a bullet fired mysteriously from his own gun. Patrick McGilligan examines Lang's life and work in the new biography, Fritz Lang, The Nature of the Beast. Lang was brilliant at using shadows, and he influenced later film noir directors.
Well, I think it's his visual style, really, that excited cineasts from the beginning. In Germany, during the Expressionist era in the 1920s, and then he followed through and made that part of his signature throughout his entire career. And he was obsessed with the darkness and very slight illumination. He would love to do a scene with just a candle and figure out how to photograph it. And he was very concerned with visual effects and with creating new visual effects and exciting ones that would kind of shock people. And literally in the 1920s, there would be scenes that he had sometimes crafted by hand on the actual frame of film, animating something so that it would pop out of the screen and people in the theater would gasp, you know, in shock. And so he was, and a lot of people, and I think if you read the book, in a sense, his own life story is full of darkness and shadows and murky, strange doings and as I say, intimations of vice and crime. So I think in a way it was a reflection of his psychology.
One of his most famous films, and in fact one of the most influential of the silent films, is Metropolis, which is about a futuristic city built on slave labor. The way you describe the making of that movie, it both earned him his reputation as a brilliant filmmaker and also earned his reputation as a sadistic director. I want you to choose a scene from that movie that's visually stunning and tell us what went into that scene that earned him the reputation for being sadistic.
Yes. One of the most famous scenes in the film is when the undercity is flooded, the subterranean part of Metropolis where all the workers are slaves is flooded by explosions when all the workers try to rebel and overthrow the master Metropolis. And he had little children there that had been rounded up, you know, from the poor sections of Berlin, promising them candy and food for the day and teddy bears and this sort of thing, which his wife would be on the sidelines providing because she was the good heart, Thea von Harbo, his scenarist and collaborator. And people said even with the children there, you know, that he would force them to go back into the water and in the cold water and do take after take where their lives would be virtually in jeopardy. And in fact, there were moments during the making of that film when Brigitte Helm, who is plays the Maria, the sort of Madonna and Frankenstein monster, that she plays two parts in the film. At the end, when she's burned at the stake as the Frankenstein monster, the creation, the robot creation, you know, he kept piling the flames on higher and higher until I spoke to one eyewitness who was there on the set, Kurt Siodmak, who later also emigrated to America, and he said she was being singed. She finally fled from the set in tears, and everybody was just, you know, shocked and angry and, you know, but nobody could tell this man no. He was at the height of his power when he was making Metropolis.
Let me move on to M, Fritz Lang's first talking movie and one of his most famous films. And M has just been restored, and there's a few cities lucky enough to have that movie to see. M starred Peter Lorre as a child murderer hiding out from the police. Fritz Lang wanted an unknown actor. I didn't know until I read your book that Peter Lorre had worked with Bertolt Brecht before making M. He'd played a sex maniac in one of his plays, played a gangster in the Brecht-Weil musical Happy End. What do you think is extraordinary about Laurie's performance in M?
Well, Laurie was bullied by Lang into the performance that we see on the screen, and it was really a kind of merciless treatment. Laurie almost had a quality, even on the stage before M, of leaping out at you and having a charisma and a magnetism. And Lang wanted someone who would project an ordinary person, but also fear, compassion. You know, eventually the trick of that movie is to turn you around into feeling some kind of compassion and pity for this child murderer.
Yeah, someone who can't help himself.
Yes. I think partly we feel that pity because Fritz Lang was, you know, abusing him so strongly in the making of the film, making him do take after take, and one scene throwing him down the stairs a dozen times when he enters into the tribunal of the beggar underworld, till so literally he was, again, black and blue and begging for mercy from his director. And that's what we see on the screen, him begging for mercy from us.
Do you think that Fritz Lang's sadism actually succeeded in bringing out more drama from his star? Some actors would probably say they would have given a great performance with or without Fritz Lang leaning on them so hard.
Some did. Henry Fonda said he would have given the same performance if Fritz Lang hadn't, you know, told him how to move his finger every which way, because Fritz Lang really wanted his actors to be puppets. He wanted to control their slightest movement. In Germany, I think it's true that his, and sadism might be too strong a word, but he definitely had sadistic methods. And I think for the kinds of films that he was making, that type of control over people really created the effect that we see on the screen. I think it's one of the reasons why the performance in Metropolis of Brigitte de Helm is still so revelatory, because you really are seeing someone who is being punished, you know, on the screen by the director. Same with Peter Lorre and M. In America, it didn't work for him. In America, the star system, to some extent, defeated him. Stars were more powerful than directors in America, and he couldn't mistreat some people who were being paid more than him, whose importance to the production superseded his. And he got in trouble when he would maltreat the big stars. So eventually he would end up picking on anybody. You know, he'd kind of roam the set looking for someone to make his victim. And quite often it would be an unknown leading lady. You know, quite often it was the leading ladies.
One of the stories of Lang's life that was very mysterious had to do with his first wife's death. She died by a gunshot. Some people say that Lang fired the gun, others that it was a suicide. Did you investigate the story, and what did you find?
Well, one legend of Lang's, which he never explored in print, was the existence of his first wife, which was simply rumored. I had no evidence of it. It had never appeared in print. And yet there was a kind of scuttlebutt in film circles. It turns out, after much research, that he was married before he was married to Thea von Harbou. And there literally, I could find no proof of her existence except her name scribbled on a family record in the Vienna City Hall. And even that can't be counted on to be her name, because it could have been a stage name. So I had to reconstruct the story through a variety of sources, the best of which was probably Fritz Lang's own version told to an actor friend who was one of two people named in his will as someone who might inherit part of his estate. And that was his own version, which pretty much protested his innocence in the situation. I think there's no question he was married once before Thea von Harbou, and that she died violently in his presence by his gun. Some people thought it was murder. Some people thought it was manslaughter. Some people thought it was an accident. It took place in Berlin in 1920 or early 1921. The police were called in because he was already a prominent director. The studio and producers moved in. He was accused of murder. He definitely faced some kind of police investigation. And what he told Howard Vernon, his actor friend, who was one of the people named in his will, so therefore would be a pretty good source, was that it was an accident, that she had come in on him while he was having this affair with Thea von Harbou, and she had gotten distraught and hysterical and went into the bathtub and committed suicide. There are a lot of discrepancies in this story, as I recounted from various points of view in the book. And I think he felt very guilty about it. And I think that he felt guilty, and that's reflected in a lifetime of films that are about guilt, murder, quite often murder of chorus girls or actresses or young women who have some kind of disreputable aspect about them. And frequently, frequently the accused are protesting their innocence, whether it be in Fury or his last American film, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt.
When Fritz Lang came to America from Germany, what are some of the differences he had to adjust to in Hollywood?
Well, when he came to America, you have to understand at that point in time, he is 45 years old, so he's middle-aged. He's a legend in Europe. In America, he's only known among the cognoscenti. Only the most sophisticated filmgoers have heard of him. Now, that includes, to some extent, some producers and some Hollywood people, and that's one of the reasons why he was recruited. But he always had a psychological complex after that of having to reintroduce himself, and his publicity was constantly reasserting the point that he had been a legend prior to arriving in Hollywood. And now, also, he was a god. He was a god in Berlin and in Germany at his height. And even though he had trouble with studios and with producers, he pretty much got his way, and his whim was an order. Now, in Hollywood, it was quite different. There was the star system. There were producers to cope with. There were studios who had styles that must be followed. And almost immediately, he came a cropper with the studios. He made his first film was Fury, starring Spencer Tracy as a man protesting his innocence in the face of a mob lynching. And it's a brilliant film, which especially in its time was greatly admired. And but he drove everyone at MGM crazy. He drove the crew crazy. He drove the producer crazy till eventually, even though the film was released and got wonderful reviews, he was fired. He was thrown out of MGM. And one by one, you know, he went through the various studios in Hollywood and was fired or alienated them with his behavior until finally, you know, he would be towards the end of his career in the 1940s. He's working at Republic, the lowliest of the you know, shoestring studios.
Perhaps the most admired of his American films is The Big Heat, a gangster film from 1953. Where do you think that fits into the larger genre of American gangster films?
Well, The Big Heat he made at the twilight of his career, and I think he needed a film like that for us to call him great still, because he had gone through a period of time and some inferior films. And I think with The Big Heat, he stumbled into a genre and an area that was perfect for him. He returned to the crime film, and because he was older and wiser, I think you see a much more intelligent script, which pretty much pre-existed before him, but every little thing he did to accent it was right. He brought a wisdom, he brought a grace to it. And I think, like M, even though The Big Heat is a very violent film and has some shocking episodes, like Lee Marvin throwing scalding coffee in Gloria Graham's face, scenes that even today when you see them kind of take you aback, and are a kind of reflection of his previous, you know, sadomasochism on the screen that had really been his hallmark earlier in his career. It's a tremendously tender and compassionate film, so that by the end, he is, as with Peter Lorre and M, you know, asking for forgiveness and compassion towards some of the characters in the film who are very ambiguous.
My guest is Patrick McGilligan. He's written a new biography of Fritz Lang. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick McGilligan, author of a new biography of film director Fritz Lang. One of the amazing things about Fritz Lang's career is that, you know, he starts making incredible silent movies that are still classics today. And then in 1953, he makes a film that becomes a classic, The Big Heat. That's really quite a span. I'm wondering what the transition was like for him from silent films to sound films, and also what the transition was in getting a more contemporary style of acting from the people that he worked with.
Well, the transition from silent to sound was greatly aggravated in his case by the fact that it virtually coincided with his leaving Germany and having to learn a whole new language and culture eventually in America. It also coincided with losing his wife, Thea von Harbo, who stayed behind in Germany and who had written all of his films, and consequently, he had lost his voice at the point in time when he needed someone to write dialogue for him. He lost his great writer, his great collaborator, as well as his wife. So when he came to America, part of his real difficulty in his career and a real subtext of his problems after arriving in America was that he constantly was looking for a script. He was constantly looking for a writer who would somehow attach himself to Lang. And he would be constantly alienating them at the same time. So there was never a case of finding another Thea von Harbo for him. So at the point in time in which he needed to have dialogue and to have actors speak, he really lost and had to constantly attempt to recoup that ground.
Two movies that relate to Fritz Lang have been re-released. One of them is M, and I understand there's very few prints of this restored version in the States now, but you might find it coming to your city. And also Contempt, a Jean-Luc Godard movie that Lang is featured in, playing a director. Tell us a little bit about Lang's role in Godard's Contempt.
Well, the French New Wave idolized Lang, and Godard in particularly idolized him. And think how lovely it was that a man who had started his film career right after World War I could end his film career in a French New Wave picture playing himself. He's playing a variation on himself. Godard had written the role for Cocteau, who was ill, and instead he gave it to Lang. And it's a very moving film, partly because Lang is in it. It's a very interesting film anyway because of what it's about. But Lang is treated as a kind of exemplar and as a kind of giant of the profession, the last of his kind. Lang would always refer to himself as a dinosaur. He's treated as one of the last of the dinosaurs. And there are very moving moments where Godard just gives the film over to Lang and lets him talk, or even lets him just walk as the camera follows him and he lights a cigarette. And the audience watches this man who can no longer get work in Hollywood, who is appearing with Brigitte Bardot and Jack Palance in a French New Wave film. And I think that's one of the reasons why that film gives audiences such a charge, because of that juxtaposition.
Many of Fritz Lang's movies are on video, silence and sound films. Recommend a couple of your favorites for people to get at the video store. And I'll remind people to look in your repertory theater for Contempt and for M.
Yes, well, Lang is lucky. He's fortunate in the sense that his work survives him a lot in a more widespread fashion than most directors. You can actually get almost all of his great German silent films in America in video, and that everything from his, you know, pre-1920 The Spiders serial to the first very long Dr. Mabuse film, to Die Nibelungen, to The Woman in the Moon, to Metropolis, to M, which is a talking picture. And then by the time you get to America, ironically, some of the American films you can't see, and you have to try and catch them on television if you're lucky, because at the point at which he stopped working for the studios and was really kind of running from low-budget place and independent company to independent company, some of those films have gone out of circulation. But you can get some of the more famous American films like You Only Live Once or Scarlet Street. You can get The Big Heat, and you can get Contempt. And in that range, you really have not only the entire range of his career, but really the history of the cinema.
Well, Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much for talking with us about Fritz Lang and his films.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Fritz Lang, The Nature of the Beast. Lang's 1931 film M has been re-released. It's currently playing in Philadelphia. Friday it opens in Portland. In August it begins opening in many cities around the country. You can see Lang in the Godard film Contempt, which has also been re-released.